John Nixon, you're a former CIA senior analyst. Your book, Debriefing the President, The Interrogation of Saddam Hussein. It's really a pleasure to be speaking with you. I could not put the book down, so I appreciate your time.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
So let's start a little bit. I want a little bit about you. You, 13 years in CIA as an analyst, you studied Iran, Iraq, North Korea. Was that your intent? There was an interest in the Middle East when you were younger. Not that you necessarily wanted to get into government, but you landed there.
Yes.
But there's always been this kind of passion, this interest in that area. Tell me a little bit about that, how that all got started.
Sure. Well, I was always interested in foreign countries and foreign places. And, you know, originally, as an undergraduate, it was the Soviet Union. But by the time I was in graduate school, the Soviet Union was no more. So, you know, I just kind of moved to Washington, and I started working here and did a few things. But I eventually began to gravitate towards the Middle East and getting to know and studying some of these places. And that's around the time that I got recruited by the CIA, and fortunately they put me in as a leadership analyst, which studying the sort of the following the leaders of a nation, if you will, analyzing their every move, and on Iraq. And that was really, really great, because at the time, which was 1998, Iraq was considered one of the top tier national security issues for the United States.
And then let's fast forward to December 2003, January 2004. You were the first American to conduct a prolonged interrogation of Saddam Hussein after his capture by the U.S. forces.
Yeah.
You spent all this time studying Saddam Hussein. You said you felt like you knew him. What
yeah.
do you mean by that?
Well, in the overall arc of his career and of his regime, I think that being at the CIA was a great perch to learn about him, because you got to see all the classified, but also the non-classified, the open source information. And it's very important if you're gonna be an intelligence analyst to sort of take those two realms of information and sort of smash them together, because that you get a much fuller picture. And I felt that there were so many things that I could talk to him about. And also, during our debriefing, he was always testing me to see if I knew things, because if I didn't know something, he would then act as though, oh, well, we can't talk about this because you don't even know about it. And so it was a very challenging sort of match wits with, this evil dictator. And one of the things that happened, though, during the debriefing process was that I began to see certain things that we didn't know about Saddam. And those were really eye-opening, and they were kind of mind-blowing a little bit. They were certainly surprising, and it really began to change my analysis and my understanding of who I was talking to.
And how did you, let's go just digress a little bit, John, is how were you the guy that was selected to talk to him first? Was it because of your training, because you had some pretty in-depth expert knowledge of him? How did that happen? Was it a given? Once we capture Saddam, John, you're going to be the guy that goes in and talk to him. I don't think it quite went down that way.
Yeah, no. I had worked on him. I was working on Iran around the time that the war started. So Saddam wasn't my chief responsibility anymore. But what happened was that the analyst, we had this position in Baghdad. It was called the HVT-1 analyst job. And that HVT-1 stands for High Value Target Number One, which was Saddam's sort of secret designation. And the person who was the analyst in Baghdad interfacing with the military to kind of help them sort of find where he might be hiding had to come home. And so they asked me to go out and replace him. And I was only too eager. I had volunteered to go, and then that's when they said to me, well, can you do this for us? And I said, absolutely, because I thought that's where my strengths lie. And so, part of it is knowing, like, people knew that I had a pretty good reputation for understanding who this guy was and knowing a lot about him, but also part of it was being in the right place at the right time.
Well, and there's no disputing, you don't dispute it, none of us dispute that he was a ruthless dictator.
He
did some pretty evil, nasty things to people.
Yes, absolutely.
But you also say that we we really didn't know him. We had all these perceptions, and you said it was, you know, surprising. And even reading through the book, it's like, this is really surprising what we were led to believe by, I don't know if it was through intelligence, if it's through our media, where that came from. Tell us about some of those perceptions and what surprised you the most in talking with Saddam Hussein.
Well, you know, over decades, the United States foreign policy is governed by, sometimes it's governed by our fears rather than by our strengths. And we have a tendency to sort of pick out individuals throughout the world who we become kind of obsessed with. And Saddam Hussein was one of them. You know, there were others. There was Gamal Abdel Nasser of Egypt in the 50s and 60s. There was Yasser Arafat, the head of the PLO, in the 70s. Ayatollah Khomeini in Iran in the 70s and 80s. Gaddafi in the 80s also. But Saddam seemed to be the most recent one, and he was an obsession of ours for a long time. And, you know, when you spend so much time looking at this person and trying to kind of outmaneuver them, you know, so many people are working on it, and the sources of information had been drying up on us because we had no official presence in the country. And so we were starting to get a lot of information that was really kind of lousy, and it just sort of started to shape our analysis. And no matter how much we tried to kind of cut away things that we didn't believe in, there was a lot of stuff that was shaping our analysis and making our analysis worse rather than better. So that was a problem in and of itself. I felt that certainly when I got to meet him, there were a couple of things that really, one of the really, really stunning facts was that Saddam really thought that 9/11 is a pivotal moment in the U.S.-Iraq relationship, because 9/11, I believe, is when the Bush administration really decides that he's got to go. They came into office thinking of him as unfinished business from the first Gulf War and George Bush's father's presidency. But they hadn't really decided what they were going to do about him. But then once 9/11 happens, they decide he's got to go, and immediately start looking for linkages between Saddam and 9/11. And when I talked to Saddam, he thought the opposite. He thought that 9/11 was going to bring the United States and Iraq closer together, that the United States would have to see that he was not involved, that no Iraqis were involved, that the enemies, the people that carried out the 9/11 attack, were the same enemies that Saddam had. And you know something, he couldn't have been more wrong. And
now, did you believe him? Do you believe that?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. One of the areas where I think we really fell down was in viewing Saddam's own members of the Sunni Islamic community in Iraq. Saddam was basically the leader of this group. That was his power base. These were the people that he represented, and these are the people that supported him. Now, Saddam was very concerned that Islamic extremists, Wahhabists from Saudi Arabia, and who were bringing their ideas of Wahhabism into the country, and Saddam was very concerned that they were going to sort of infect his power base. And so he spent a great deal of time and effort, and this is true all the way up until the end. He always maintained attention towards his own security. He was afraid that this was going to infect his power base, and that this was the greatest threat to his regime, not the United States, not Iran even, but this, Islamic extremism. And so, yes, I do believe him. And, you know, something, he was very good at rooting these people out and always making sure that he had his people listening in on them.
Well, and tell me too, John, when you were, he did not like the word interrogation.
Right.
So he didn't use that word. It was more, I think the question is how did you build rapport with him to get him to trust you to engage? Because he obviously could have made the choice to not have that conversation. How did you build that rapport with him?
Well, certainly we appealed to his vanity. And we told him that, you know, hey, this is your chance to kind of get your story, your side of things out there. And the people that are going to be reading what we write are the people at the highest levels of our government, meaning, you know, the president. And that appealed to him because I think he had things he wanted to say and he wanted our government to know about. And, you know, there was also, I think, a sort of a more mercenary side to this as well, in the sense that Saddam didn't really want to be sitting in his cell all by himself with nothing to do. That, I think, didn't appeal to him at all. So he was more than happy to kind of talk to us. Also, in talking to us, he would have the opportunity to figure out what it is we wanted to know. And that would give him a sense of what might be asked in any sort of trial or any sort of legal process that was probably going to come. And it would also have the added benefit of enabling him to try out his answers and see what stuck and what didn't. And I think that he saw this as sort of a win-win for himself. Saddam could be very candid when he wanted to be. And he liked to talk, and he liked to talk about himself. He just didn't like to talk about things that were of sort of a sensitive nature, such as things, intelligence and regime security and his own personal security. Those are the things that he would say like, but now we're not talking about history, we're talking about interrogation, and I won't do that. And so it was always sort of a cat and mouse game with him.
Yeah, he didn't seem to be very fond of being held accountable for anything.
No, well, you know, I said this the other day in one interview. I said, you know, talking to Saddam Hussein was sort of like talking. It was like reading a bad Washington memoir in which everything that happened that was good, he was more than willing to take credit for. But anything that happened that was bad, it was never his fault, and it was always someone else's fault.
And what was the duration of your time with him from the day you first went in and saw him sitting there to when you departed?
Well, the first time I saw him was the night that he was captured, and I was brought out. He was flown down from Tikrit to Baghdad, and I was brought out to the airport to meet him. And it was my job to identify him and make sure that we didn't pick up the wrong guy. And it was very easy for me to do because the minute I saw him, I mean, there was just no doubt in my mind. Although I had a whole protocol of things that, you know, I was going to do, that I actually did in terms of verifying him. But, you know, I really didn't even need to do that. But so there was the first night, and then Saddam basically sat in his cell for about a week, and nobody talked to him, and nobody came out to see him. And then starting around the 20th of December, and going for every day, almost every day, from the 20th of December to January 12th, I spent time talking to, I was going to call the book Tuesdays with Saddam, but, you know, that title was already taken. But that's the time span we're talking about here.
And what was the day like? Was it one session, two sessions? How much time would you spend with him?
Well, we never wanted him to get too comfortable with us because once a detainee gets comfortable with the sort of the rhythm of any sort of meetings and a schedule is developed, then they get very settled in, and then it's harder to kind of get the information out of them. So we always varied our schedule and we always varied our times with him. A lot of times we would do like a session in the morning and a session in the afternoon, or sometimes we just have one really long session in the middle of the day. The shortest I met with him was about it was my last day there, and it was for about maybe between 30 and 40 minutes. And, but it was really fascinating because he, you know, when I told him I was leaving, you know, he gave me this send off that was just, you know, he just kind of grabbed me and he wouldn't let go. And you know, when you shake hands with somebody and they're holding onto your hand and it's starting to get uncomfortable because you're wondering when this person's going to let go. And that's exactly what it was like. And, you know, he just told me, you know, oh, you know, the reason we've disagreed is because you are where you are and I am here. But, you know, I want you to go back. And when you go back, remember the two greatest traits that anyone can ever have in life is to be just and fair. And, you know, and then he went on and on and on, and it was just, it was one of these surreal moments in our meetings.
Another thing I found interesting, too, is that you wrote that when the U.S. arrived, there was no plan. Saddam didn't have a plan. Everyone thought he had a plan. But he was pretty much kind of he improvised a lot, kind of ad-libbed.
And that was his genius, really, you know, because it's like if you don't have a plan, then you don't have a plan that someone can sell to your enemy or tell your enemy where you're going to be. And it worked. It worked brilliantly because when Saddam left Baghdad, you know, he just got in the car and went. And, you know, they made it through army checkpoints. And, you know, it's pretty amazing. He was, you know, at the CIA, we always thought he was the guy with a plan, and we always thought of him as this master manipulator, and the guy who, like, he was making all the decisions, and he was always trying to outfox us, and he was thinking two and three and four steps ahead of us, and, you know, sometimes, and this is a sort of a pitfall of intelligence analysis, you start building up your enemy into this, and start making them into kind of 10 feet tall and omnipotent. And, you know, one of the things that I kind of felt when I was talking to him was, God, this is just a person, you know. And it's just like it sort of pierces your image of him that you realize, you know, I used to really think this guy was, you know, he could do it all, you know. And then you realize that, you know, he was operating from the same almost the same sorts of ignorance that we were. His knowledge of the United States was terrible. I mean, he totally miscalculated, underestimated the will of not only the international community to do something to prevent the Bush administration from coming in, but underestimated the will of the Americans to come and get him. The week before he's removed from power, you know, he's sending drafts of a novel to one of his aides and saying, you know, tell me what you think. Meanwhile, it's like your regime's going to be over in a few days. Yeah, and it wasn't just Saddam; it was his sons as well. I mean, they, you know,
seemed like there was a disconnect of some sort.
Well, I think this is part of. Well, I think it was part of the disengagement process that he wasn't the same Saddam that he had once been. You know, as I said earlier, he was older, and he wasn't as engaged in things, and you know, and also he didn't have a good understanding of international relations, and I think also he thought that, you know, something will happen at the last minute and save me, and, you know, it's happened so many times in the past, it'll happen again, and it didn't.
Well, one thing he also said is that the U.S. is going to fail. I mean, we don't know the language, the history, or the mind of the Iraqi people. He wasn't wrong, was he?
Oh, my God, no. you know, I was, when he said that, I never wanted to give him credit, and I never wanted to say, you know, you're right, Saddam. But in my head, I was saying, you know, you've got a point there. You know, he was absolutely right, and I spent a lot of time in Iraq during the war, and the things that I saw that just were so terrible and so embarrassing, and you know, the way that some of our people behaved incredibly well and really nobly, and you could be very proud of them, and then there were some people who just behaved so abominably. And you were, and they were so ignorant of where they were and who they were dealing with, and they made things 10 times worse by mistreating people, and it was just horrible. And you know, that phrase, you know, you're going to fail because you don't understand us, you know, that always just stuck with me. And he was right. And he also said that, you know, by removing me, you are going to create Iraq will become a playing field for jihadists, and it has.
And do you feel, John, that he should have been left in power?
I think that he was. Let me first say that I supported the war, and I thought taking him out would be a good thing because I thought we would be put in a position where we could help the Iraqi people, build a government that might be more responsive to their needs. And having said that, I would say now, 10 years after his death, 13 years after his removal from power, I think they would be better off if Saddam were still in power, or if he had died, say, or what, something had happened to him, that the Iraqis would have made the selection. They would have made they would have provided the solution for who they wanted to lead them. And I think that people have said, well, you know, aren't we better off with Saddam gone? And I think even George Bush, this past summer, said as much to a group of veterans that he was hosting at his ranch. And I hate to answer a question with a question, but if someone says that to me, it's like, show me one thing that is better because he is gone. I can show you a lot of bad things that have happened since he's gone. 2 million people displaced in Iraq. Jihadists holding territory in holding its third largest city. Jihadists spreading into Syria. Is Israel more secure because Saddam's not there? I doubt that. And one of the most important things is the spread of Iranian power and influence in the region. Saddam and Saddam's Iraq was a natural bulwark against that. And when we took his hand off the door that was holding that shut, we allowed Iran to start to spread.
What did he say about weapons of mass destruction?
He was very clear. See, one of the traits of Saddam was his secretiveness. He was one of the most secretive men I've ever, and suspicious. And when you talked to him, after a while, you became kind of suspicious also. And now one of the great traits of him, for him, in terms of governing and leading Iraq, was his secretiveness. He was able to keep his enemies off balance because they never could figure out what he was up to or what he wanted to do. The downside to that was that even when he was telling you the truth, you didn't believe him. You thought he was holding back or he was lying. And that's exactly what was happening when I was debriefing him. We were talking about weapons of mass destruction, and he said, I don't have them. I shut my program down years ago, and I had no intention of starting up again. And who needs these things? And at first, I didn't believe him. And we went at this for probably, this was the most talked about topic of all the topics we discussed. And even by the very end, I was starting to have doubts, but I still believed that the weapons of mass destruction existed. And it wasn't until I got back to headquarters and I started talking with some of my colleagues and also started going through the debriefing notes of some of the other key senior officials and some of the documentation and started to come to the conclusion that, yeah, he's telling the truth here. And, in this regard, I think Saddam was his own worst enemy. But if I can say this, WMD, the issue of WMD and the decision to invade Iraq, WMD is almost irrelevant to the decision to invade Iraq, or at least that's the way I see it now, because if it wasn't WMD, it would have been something else. The Bush administration was hell-bent on getting rid of him. And even if he had produced incontrovertible evidence saying that that Iraq didn't have weapons of mass destruction, again, the Bush administration would have found another pretext to launch this attack.
Well, let's fast forward to when you left Iraq. You came back to the United States and met with President Bush and the CIA, the analysts, the intelligence. That I found just as equally fascinating. It seems to be there's this dissension or divisiveness within the agencies, which still obviously appears to remain today.
Yeah.
Was that what you felt? I mean, that was the takeaway I got from the book and what you wrote.
There's always, in any time when say, for example, war, you're always going to get differences of opinion based on agencies, because agencies have their own prerogatives and they have their own agendas, and they're all vying for the president's ear, and they're all vying for a slice of the federal budget and a bigger slice of the federal budget every year. Now, having said that, I found that Iraq, one of the things that I came away from those years after Saddam was removed was that we were in this really terrible conflict now that was just, it was just getting worse and worse by the day. And the White House suddenly started to reach out because they felt that the interagency process that where, you know, used to be that the agencies would work together and they would produce some sort of an analytic product or something along those lines and give it to the White House. And we weren't able to do that anymore, you know, because of so much dysfunction. And also, you know, some of the things that were going up to the White House were, you know, so watered down, you know. This is the harmful effect of politicization of intelligence, you know. And part of it was because the CIA had been turned into the whipping boy of the Bush administration. Part of it also was that, you know, in retaliation for that, members of the CIA, high officials of the CIA, I should say, were leaking, and there was a lot of leaking done during that war. It was shocking, leaking documents to the press in order to sort of derail administration's policies, and you get this sort of dysfunctional relationship in which everybody's kind of fighting with each other, and it makes for a very, very difficult time. And it's one of the reasons why I think the United States, if we're going to fight a war, we really need to fight a war that's very quick and get in, get out, and get it done. Because the longer these things go on, the more politicized they become. And I certainly, by the end of my time at the CIA, one of the things that struck me when I was first starting was that no matter what, the White House always wanted to know what the CIA had to say, and it always wanted our take on something, and it always listened to what it is we said. And by the end of my time at the CIA, that wasn't the case anymore. You know, that the White House was now becoming very selective about what it wanted to hear from the CIA, and it didn't buy into things that you told it, and it was just, I felt like nobody really cared what we had to say.
You know, and it's interesting too, because at the start of our conversation off air, I had mentioned how what you were battling then, or what the narrative, it seems like everything is a narrative, fitting somebody's narrative, telling them what they want to hear as opposed to telling them the truth. And I said, that doesn't seem to be much different than what we're dealing with today. It almost seems worse.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, something that is so dangerous. And you've got to, I will say this, when I kind of went and talked to President Bush in the Oval Office and Vice President Cheney in his office, there is an overwhelming desire to want to say something that makes their day a little bit better and sort of lightens the load for them. Nobody likes to be the bearer of bad news, and you have to fight that at all costs. Because the intelligence agencies, particularly the CIA, I mean, we all work for the president, and that's the way it should be. And we all want to make the president, you know, as smart as possible on a certain issue, and we all serve the president. But there's that, and then there's telling the president what he wants to hear, and it's a fine line. I found so many times at the agency that people stepping over that line, particularly on the seventh floor, and you know, that's the thing. Once that starts to happen, you know, it's like that scene in Zoolander when they're having the mocha shakes, and they're at the gas station, and they start throwing the gasoline around on each other, and then one lights a cigarette. You know, that's kind of what it's like, because you're just playing with fire at that point. And everybody got burned by this during the Iraq War. So I think that the CIA does best when it leaves the politics at the front door. And what we really need to do is have somebody, you know, we need to have a president and a CIA director who are on the same wavelength and who recognize their strengths and weaknesses, and and what their roles are, and what, and we have to have a president and a director, a director who knows what can and can't be done, and a president who knows like what intelligence can do for me and what it can't do. For years, we've had, you know, whether it was Clinton, Bush, Obama, they all act as though we have like the crystal ball in the basement. And unfortunately, that idea only gets played up by, you know, the people on the seventh floor of the CIA, because they want to, they kind of want to con the president into thinking that's true, because they have every, they have a vested interest in making them believe that. And, you know, something, and that's, it's decisions like that that are just terrible. And, you know, we've got to go back to, like, a CIA that tells the president, I don't care if you like it or you don't, this is our best take, and leave it at that. And don't fall into this trap of, you know, stretching the analysis and you know, and ginning it up so that you can catch his eye and you know, give him the shiny object.
Well, and you write in the book too, and you say this about Clinton, Bush, and Obama as well, that the people who need to do the most soul searching about the uses of intelligence are the presidents themselves.
Absolutely.
And I think that's something that we really is a great takeaway that maybe, I don't know how we get that message across,
it's particularly important now, especially with President-elect Trump, who does not have the background of, I mean, this is unusual territory for us to be in, because this is somebody who does not have the national security and foreign policy making background that we've come to expect in presidents. And, you know, I've been hearing some good things about his director, Mike Pompeo, and that, you know, he wants to kind of come in and shake things up a little bit and also cut the bloat. And, you know, and Dan Coats is actually, who's going to be the director for national intelligence, is a very solid guy. So I'm a little bit encouraged. You know, I've got my fingers crossed, and you know, we'll have to see. But you know, it's a community. Despite all of my criticisms in the book, I'm still a great believer in intelligence and what the intelligence community can do for the president. Because you know something, there's no alternative. We live in a world in which you absolutely have to have access to this information, and you have to have good people doing it, and you've got to have people who understand its strengths and its weaknesses, and who are not going to shoot the messenger.
And John, looking back at it now, your time with Saddam and the interrogation process, would you have done anything differently?
I would have said, hey, why don't we do this over a much, I would have like gone back to headquarters and demanded that we do some like really like bring them back to the United States and do like really long term, you know, debriefing process and learn as much as we possibly can from him. But I mean, that's ridiculous in the sense that that was never going to happen. But you know, if I could have had done something, that would have been it. Because I have to admit, when I was done with him, when I went back to the United States, I kind of couldn't wait to get away, because you know, he was not a likable person, and you just didn't, after a while, you just didn't want to be around him. But I subsequently, years later, I think of him, and I think of questions I'd love to ask, and some of these things are just lost to history now.
Well, that's interesting too, because when you went, you knew you were going to write a book at this. I mean, how could you not journal this, write this book, and get this out? There was some difficulty finding an agent and publisher, because they said no one would be interested in it, which that kind of floored me a little bit. It's like, you've got to be kidding. But now that you have this out, making the rounds, everybody wants to talk to you. This information is fascinating to me, human behavior and why people do what they do. What has this work meant to you, getting this word out, the reception you've gotten from the public, and then just for your own personal self?
Well, I'm kind of overwhelmed by the response, because, you know, like you said, 5 years ago, I was being told that no one's really interested and people want to just move on and, you know, no thanks. And it just it reasserts my belief in you know that people want to know things, you know, and that maybe we can avoid for I don't know how long, but at least we can avoid for the near future replaying this fiasco. I am overjoyed that people are taking this seriously, and that there has been the response to the book has been overwhelmingly positive. And that's true also of some of my colleagues in the intelligence community. There are some, I think, who are kind of giving me the cold shoulder, and they're not going to comment on this because they don't want to give me the benefit of that. And I'm kind of still waiting for a little bit of a backlash from some of those people and from some of the Bush people. But you know something? I didn't write the book for them. I wrote it because I wanted it to be an accurate record of what happened. And I, you know, there's too much lying that goes on in American life today. And one of the things that has been most rewarding is to see how people react to the truth. You know, it's one of the reasons why I think the book is doing so well. It's because it is truthful. And you know, the truth is a wonderful thing if everybody would just try it once.
Well, yeah, we humans seem to have an issue with handling the truth. I think there was a quote in some movie.
Jack Nicholson.
Yeah.
I forget what the name of that movie was. A Few Good Men.
Yes, and we do have an issue with the truth, hearing it and speaking it. So that's a whole other topic. What's next for you?
That's a great question. Right now, I mean, there's a number of things that are going on with the book and with some possible projects related to the book, which should keep me busy. I would like very much to write another book, perhaps on Iran, because I worked on Iran also at the agency, and something that I think is especially important as we move into this new administration, in which, you know, Trump's national security team seems to have a very strong hawkish feeling against Iran. And, you know, I think that, you know, I think it's time for some new thinking on Iran, and to be quite frank with you, I think that we have tried the hard line against Iran for a long time, and it's never gotten us anywhere. And in fact, it's been counterproductive. And I think I would hope that the new administration would rethink some of these things, but we'll see. But you know, so it's another book possibly.
Have any of the administrations reached out to you?
Some people have kind of talked to me about sort of third parties have kind of reached out, and you know, I'm kind of mulling things over right now. I'm not sure. You know, I have 13 years in the government, and you know, that would be a big step. So I'm kind of not sure if I want to throw my hat into the ring just yet. But and also, I think the first year of this administration might be a little bumpy, but we'll see. But if asked, I mean, I think I would probably, if asked directly, I think I would probably say I'd have to, because, you know, we need to do things a little differently, and just doing the same thing over and over again, you know, is not working. And also, you know, we live in a world where intelligence and the choices that we're going to be faced with over the next 4 to 8 years, let alone the next 20 years, are going to be just really, really important, because the region is changing. It's changing rapidly. And, you know, our role has kind of changed with it. And I still think we can take advantage of these changes and strengthen our position. You know, if we're wise, if we're unwise, we might end up doing ourselves even more harm.
Well, John Nixon, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. I mean, this information, the book, the conversation is amazing to me. It's I want to say riveting. It's, for lack of a better word.
Oh, that's a good word.
Where can we Where can our listeners find you or your work, and where can we find your book?
The book is available on Amazon and, you know, all the other book-selling websites, and it's published by Blue Rider Press, which is a division of Penguin Random House. And as far as myself goes, I think if you Google me, I've had a number of op-eds come out recently. I've just started kind of getting my name out there because for years I was prevented from doing this because I worked for the CIA, and you know, you're not allowed to, and it's not a good idea to do it. Number one, number two, you're not allowed to do it. Even now, I still have to. Whenever I write anything, if I write anything that's pertinent to what it is I worked on when I was at the agency, I still have to turn it into them for them to review. And it took me 14 months to get, all told, it took me 14 months to get this manuscript back from them. And
because they reviewed it twice, right?
Yes, they did. And I mean, it was one of the most galling experiences and this whole process. There's no transparency in the process. It's sort of like taking a note, putting it in a bottle, and throwing it in the ocean, hoping that somebody in England gets it. and you won't know until that person calls you up saying they got the note. But I will say this, that their dilly-dallying and their kind of putting this through the stuff ended up being good for the book, because now it's come out now instead of last August, and it's been much better in terms of this is a better time, I think, a time where people are more receptive to the message.
Well, John, again, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. The book, Debriefing the President, The Interrogation of Saddam Hussein, John Nixon. Like I said, it's been an honor and pleasure speaking with you. Thank you.
All right, great. Thank you very much for having me.